tonight on Arena. Wes Anderson on his new movie, Asteroid City, and India Knight on transposing Nancy Mitford's The Pursuit of Love to contemporary Britain. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. With his strikingly vibrant visual flair and a penchant for what we can certainly call esoteric storytelling, the writer and director Wes Anderson is very much his own cinematic genre. This has been the case since he started making movies, and now, after more than 25 years in the business and on the cusp of releasing his 11th feature, he is probably realising that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, even if the Imitator is an AI program entertaining people on Twitter. More on that anon. The Wes Anderson cinematic universe, vast and layered, contains adored films like Fantastic Mr. Fox, The Royal Tenenbaums and The Grand Budapest Hotel. And now he's back with Asteroid City, a wistful comedic tale within a tale set in 1955, chiefly concerned with strange goings-on in a small desert town famous for the meteorite that blasted a crater into the landscape there thousands of years ago. In the weekend where we set our scene, astronomers and the military are hosting five so-called junior stargazers, science award-winning genius children, their parents and their inventions. But that is to ignore the play within the play element of this film, which unfolds in a most intriguing and unusual way. And the cast? I'll go alphabetically on this one. Seems kind of appropriate. Adrian Brody, Steve Carell, Jarvis Cocker, Bryan Cranston, Willem Dafoe, Hope Davis, Matt Dillon, Tom Hanks, Scarlett Johansson, Edward Norton, Margaret Robbie, Jason Schwartzman, Tilda Swinton, and the list actually goes on from there. It truly is a star-studded film. Asteroid City opens this weekend, and I'm delighted to say that I spoke to Wes Anderson earlier today in his only Irish interview. Before we hear from him, let's get a flavour of the film. In this scene, junior stargazer parents are drinking vending machine martinis and swap notes on their overachieving children, while motel manager Steve Carell earwigs Liev Schreiber, Hope Davies and Stephen Park among the actors whose voices you'll hear.
I strongly question whether your daughter's silly putty resembles anything from outer space.
It's not silly putty. It's called S'mores Tosium.
This is excellent.
Thank you. It's really all the machine's doing.
What the devil do you know about astrogeology anyway, JJ, whatever that stands for?
I just maintain the workings.
Kelly's thesis is supported by...
flimsy, outdated evidence.
I beg your pardon.
Not in my opinion. I like the silly putty or S'mores Tosium. In fact, I'm just quoting what he said.
Your son's project might very well have killed us all today, by the way.
Coming from the family that brought us the electromagnetic
death
ray.
It's a weapon. Of course it's lethal.
So you admit it.
Not to mention Brainiac's flag. I mean, is he trying to provoke World War III or something?
The jet propulsion belt is eminently safe. I'd allow an 8-year-old boy to operate it. In fact, I did. Ricky's cousin Chip, and he broke the solo flight altitude record.
They're strange, aren't they? They're children, compared to normal people.
Yes.
That's correct.
It's true.
Wes Anderson, writer and director of Asteroid City. Brilliant to have you on Arena with us this evening, Wes, and congratulations on the film. It was Bryan Cranston, I think, who put it so succinctly. I thought, thanks for explaining that to me so well, Bryan. This is a film about a TV show about a play. It really tells us how the story is told. Why did you want to tell it that way?
Well, you know, I would say sometimes... when you're, I'm in my experience, when you're writing a movie, you first there's your intentions, and then there's whatever the thing just wants to become. And the my intention was I wanted to write a role for Jason Schwartzman, and I wanted to tell a story about this father traveling across the country with his children who had experienced something catastrophic in his family, and that story, and the way it came out was we're making a film about a television show about a play being produced, and that most of the movie is a play within a television show within a film, and it's extremely complicated. Every character in the film is both the character of an actor and the character that the actor is playing, and there are at least two roles for each person, but I think you have to think about it much when you watch the movie. I think it leads you by the hand.
It does do that. But one of the things that really struck me was the interaction between the theatre side of the story and the film side of the story of you, like, if you like. It struck me that you were telling us something maybe about your own love of those two media.
I've always loved that, when I go to the theater, I sort of wish I could go backstage, not go backstage to meet the actors, but to be part of it, to be part of the company. I've always been drawn to that. In this story, somehow the characters, the characters of the actors who are playing these roles became the same as the roles they're playing. And we sort of have the emotions and the life experiences that are happening move back and forth between the performers and the performances in a way that we didn't quite anticipate when we started writing the movie.
You took a picture of me.
Uh-huh.
Why?
I'm a photographer.
You didn't ask permission.
I never ask permission.
Why not?
Because I work in trenches, battlefields, and combat zones.
Really?
Uh-huh.
You mean you're a war photographer?
Mostly. Sometimes I cover sporting events. My name is Augie Steenbeck.
Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with that picture?
Well, if it's any good, I guess I'll try to sell it to a magazine, now that you mention it. Midge Campbell, eating a waffle.
I can't imagine, though, that you don't have everything planned out very meticulously before you go into a shoot, because it is such a complicated structure. You can't kind of free fall into that.
I have to say, I do tend to plan it out pretty carefully. Over the years, I learned that the more precisely I get myself ready, the more free I can be and the less likely I am to make a mistake. And even the description of this movie has probably got listeners extremely confused. But I think the way it's told is actually quite careful. And I think the cast we have is so good. They pull you into it, I would hope. And you can experience the story without this all being a distraction.
Yeah, because I'm quoting Bryan Cranston, I think, when he said your direction to these actors was just tell the story. Don't get bogged down in motivation and the like. Tell the next bit of the story. But Scarlett Johansson talked about this atmosphere on the set that was more like theatre, that they seemed to have the freedom of theatre, that space for an actor to give his or her expression and interpretation of a character within it. How important is that? How do you get that dynamic on set when you have such a meticulous structure?
Well, for instance, the Scarlett Johansson and Jason Schwartzman, they have a sort of cycle of scenes, a sort of suite of scenes together. They're staying in hotel rooms, little cottages, motel cottages across from each other. And the bathrooms have windows that face each other. And they have a series of conversations between their two windows.
This isn't the beginning of something, Augie.
Isn't it?
Is it?
Probably not.
Unless maybe it is.
I don't like the way that guy looked at us.
Okay.
The alien.
Well, how did he look
like
at us?
Like we're doomed.
Maybe we are.
Well, the place where we shot it was a desert we had sort of built, and it was a big empty place with giant rocks and mesas and sand and our little town in the middle of it. And when we shot these scenes, there was no one there. It was just this little place we'd built and just the cameraman and the person holding the boom mic. And I sent everybody else away. So for me, it's just being in a very quiet place in a little invented desert with these two actors in their windows. It was like going to a play for me. I watched Scarlett Johansson play these scenes in this window, and I was like an audience at a play. And the real thing that makes the atmosphere on the set, I think, is that these two great actors are staring at each other, playing a scene, and they bring the atmosphere more than anything that I could do.
And it's not always just two-handers like that. There are scenes here where we have 8, 9, and 10 people on the set all at the same time, dialogue overlapping, as if we're kind of in the middle of this town and there's stuff happening all over the street that you're managing to capture.
What we have is a great cast, a big cast of so many good actors. Tom Hanks, and we have Hope Davis and Liev Schreiber, and we have Tilda Swinton, and we have Matt Dillon and Adrian Brody, all sorts of people. And they, so they, when you hand them a scene, they bring it to life, and it's so much fun to have them. And that's really what, you know, carries you through.
We're also, there's an extraterrestrial element to the story, and we're in 1955 in America, very particular time, just post-war. What did that era give to you? I presume you're saying something about 2023 as well as 1955.
Yeah, well, I think, the thing with that period is there's a sort of placid surface. It's Eisenhower, America. Backyards and golf courses and Cadillacs and things. But there's paranoia. There's something left over from the war in many of these men. In our movie, you might notice that almost every man carries a pistol.
I hope you're aware. You and your accomplices may still face felony prosecution, possibly even a treason charge.
I'll fight it all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary, and win.
This just in from the president.
He's furious. Thanks a lot, Ricky.
I don't know what to say, General Gibson. I'm
sorry. Don't apologize, Dad. The public has a right to the truth.
You made your point.
This tribunal is a mockery!
What about Steenbeck, who took the photograph?
It's on the front page of every newspaper on the planet. Can't we arrest him as well?
Unfortunately, no. He dropped a print in the mail to his photo agency first thing Tuesday morning, and the postman got it before we did. He's innocent. Supposedly, he did a nude of Mitch Campbell, too.
Mitch Campbell.
And there's fear of aliens, not the big aliens with the communists, but in America they also that metaphor kind of was quite noticeable in American movies in the 50s. There were lots of stories that involved invasions and some strange paranoia of that time, and all of it sort of informs the next decade, the next generation who really react to their parents in a kind of profound way. So I guess all that kind of found its way into our story.
But that language of invasion is often, comparisons are made with the language of migration today, that it's used in a very negative way to compare it to invasion, to compare it to this kind of extraterrestrial alien idea. Was that playing on you in any way, do you think?
Well, I think when you're writing a movie, you're doing something kind of improvisational, and you're always reacting to what's going on in your life. You might be using something from your own family history or from people who you've known or just the thing you've been thinking about. But inevitably, what's going on with you day to day finds its way in. Part of what happened with this movie was the whole planet came to a halt, and we were in the strangest lockdown situation, and that certainly barged into our story, and it became a part of it. It somehow seemed right for it, oddly.
It dictated that it was there. I mean, the way you've described the set, it's such an analog set, if you like. You know, things are real. Nothing is kind of put in after the event, edited in as a special effect. The whole chatter about AI at the moment, I mean, you know the sort of memeing that is going on out there. You yourself have been, I don't know whether you consider yourself the victim of it or that, you know, are you joyous about the memeing in and around it? Are you fearful of what has been handed over to AI to create?
Well, I think, you know, I don't, for in relation to my own, the memeing of myself, I've managed to recuse myself from that. And I don't see any of it. You know, the only thing I would like to have is I'd like to AI some kind of copyright attorney and see if it can algorithm me some kind of royalty from some of this. But I'm sure that's not going to happen. I guess I don't find AI as ominous as I might. What I say is, when you sit and think about it, and when you read what people are saying about it, you start to say this is kind of doomsday, and doomsday for a lot of creative work. But I can't say that I find myself obsessed with it. I then just carry on, and we'll see where that all leads. You know, what can it do? What are its limits? Things do have limits, even when they seem a bit limitless like this. I don't know. Has someone ever told a good? Has AI done a really good joke?
I'm not sure, but video didn't kill the radio star. I doubt AI will kill the auteur.
Exactly.
Wes, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Wes Anderson, and we'll finish with a clip from Asteroid City.
Paul.
How long can they keep us in Asteroid City? Legally, I mean.
Well, I'm not an attorney, but I'd say as long as they like. I think we'd have to file an injunction and successfully argue the case 6 months to a year. Of course, we'd also need to initiate a civil suit for loss of income.
Maybe we should just walk out right now. I'm not sure they could stop us without killing somebody.
Interesting idea. What kind of mileage do you think that jetpack gets?
Ask Roger or his son. Apparently, he's being prosecuted for revealing state secrets.
I'll never make it stick.
I'm in no hurry. I like the desert. I like aliens.
Paul!
How'd you get that back? The projects remain under secure lockdown. No stargazers permitted personal access without the express permission.
My son invented this death ray.
That may be true, but my
Step
orders
back.
Are...
Easy, fellas. We're not in Guadalcanal anymore.
Okay, everyone, please. It's been a difficult quarantine.
I'll stop you right now!
Goddammit, tell them to stand down!
Stand down! You hear that? General Gibson says stand down.
You married?
Of course.
Tom Hanks and Hope Davis at the end of that scene there. We also heard the voices of Liev Schreiber and Tony Revolori in that scene from Asteroid City, which goes on general release this Friday, and we will be reviewing the Wes Anderson film on tomorrow night's Arena. You're listening to Wednesday night's Arena.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you. Getting to like you, getting to hope you like me. Getting to know you, putting it my way, but nicely.
Getting to Know You, sung there by Kelly O'Hara, one of the many memorable songs from Rodgers and Hammerstein's classic The King and I. The show comes to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre next week. I'm delighted to be joined on Arena this evening by both Anna and the King of Siam, or at least the actors who play Anna Leonones, the widow who becomes the governess to the wives and children of the stubborn King Munkut of Siam. They are Irish actor Annalene Beachy and Darren Lee, and great to have both of you with us on this Wednesday evening. Darren, in case there are any humans out there who haven't come across The King and I, and I suppose most of us probably saw it originally in the Yul Brynner, Deborah Kerr version on the TV or in the cinema, what exactly is the story that's been told in this wonderful musical, Darren?
Well, the story of The King and I takes place in 1862. It's a time when the King of Siam is concerned that his country is going to be swallowed up by surrounding powers. And so he's attempting to bring in things from Western culture. And he brings in a British school teacher to help teach his children in the hopes of moving his country forward and staying relevant. As he does so, of course, he's the ultimate ruler of his country. And so he's constantly challenged. And he has to basically face whether or not he is able to continue to rule his country, or that he has to be able to pass that opportunity on to his offspring that has been taught by this British school teacher.
And there's a whole debate here, I suppose, Darren, around modernising, how the king can modernise and yet hold on to his power. That's kind of the dilemma at the heart of the story.
That is very true. And I think it's a very relevant question, is that when... Basically, generally, we have rulers that are responsible for the community, and it is very often a conflict between the self-interest of a particular ruler and the self-interest of the full community. And so it takes a very, I think, progressive leader to be able to understand when they are no longer, or their ways have to adapt, or they're no longer appropriate to represent all the people.
And that is as true in 2023 as it was in 1860. And Annalene, playing the character of Anna Leon Owens, boy, could we do with a few people like her around. She was quite the taskmaster to face down the King of Siam and to help him and make him change his ways and modernise his methods.
Absolutely. She's a force of nature, you know, and very inspirational, I think. I mean, even in today's standards, if you imagine a widow with a young son taking herself to an unknown country and to launch herself into this incredible task that she is facing. But in 1862, the world was a much bigger place. We had no idea what was going on in countries that we had no connection to and that, you know, were not colonized by the British. And this was a very massive adventure for her and very courageous. And I think I often in my own life would like to take a leap out of her book.
Yeah, and indeed, there are diaries. I suppose the story as told in the musical has a certain, happy ever after feel to it for sure. But there are diaries, the diaries of Anna Leon Owens that give this story perhaps in a more naturalistic way. Did you go towards those in any way, Annalene, to help you with this character?
Yeah, I did initially when I very first started rehearsing for the show, which was about 5 years ago now. I did take a look at some of the pages of her diaries, and it's only one person's perspective. Mm. You know, of course, it's her reflecting on that time, and you know, there must be some embellishments here and there of her possibly considering her role to be maybe slightly more important than it actually was. But still, what she did and how she helped the king and King Chulalongkorn, Longhorn, who his son, is notable and still very important.
Yeah, and I guess at that particular period in time, the king would have thought, Darren, this is my right, my divine right, perhaps, for whatever particular divinity he was following. This is my divine right to rule and to rule as I see fit.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that that was, and it absolutely was the way of thinking. And I think that he also, of course, thought it was his divine right to be able to bring someone in. I think his only mistake was that he interpreted that he would also be able to control the way in which that information was taught. And that, you know, obviously you can't have someone who needs to bring in an outside resource also have to, by his own creation, supposed to know everything. And so it's really challenging for this person, because the idea is that he's supposed to know all the answers, and yet he needs to learn. And Anna Leon Owens finds really, really inventive ways to be able to give him the grace and opportunity to learn, as well as to be able to save face within his country and among his people.
Annalene, you're obviously that story. It's a wonderful story to tell. It's a wonderful meet in the character that you have to play. But you're coming home to play it. You're bringing it to the Bord Gáis Energy in Dublin. What does that feel like for you to be bringing it? I know you did first play it in the West End, but now you're out on tour. But coming to Ireland with it, what's that feeling?
It's a wonderful feeling. I mean, when I was a little girl, I went to remember seeing shows at the Olympia and the Gaiety and then the Point later on. And those are the moments that have changed me and molded me, where I sat in an auditorium and I watched these shows presented in front of me. And that's where I fell in love with theatre and where I fell in love with the idea of creating this magic myself, being the person that, you know, brings the audience with me and tells any story and you know, perhaps opening windows to a world that, you know, certainly me in rural Ireland had no idea about. I mean, watching things like West Side Story, Blood Brothers, Evita, Cats, even, which, you know, obviously is not based on real fact, to the best of our knowledge. But these things, they make a mark on you. And I think to be able to then bring a show here many years later and be that person is extraordinary. And I think any of us on the tour who have been to our home cities feel very proud to present the show in our cities and feel very humbled to be able to do so.
Yeah, you were born in England to Irish parents, but you returned to Wexford when you were quite young. Was there much of the grounding? I know that you eventually studied at the Ballally Theatre Company in Dublin.
Yes.
But was there much grounding in terms of that musical theatre and that direction you were going to go? Did it happen in Wexford as a young girl?
Yes, Absolutely, it did. Yeah, because when we moved over from England to Ireland, we didn't really know anybody, and my mum saw a poster in the local supermarket for a local amateur dramatic society who were looking for people to be in their production of Fiddler on the Roof, and my mum thought, "Oh, I'll go and do that, and I'll meet people." And then they needed men, so my dad joined in. And I remember sitting there watching it, thinking, this is amazing. This is such good fun. And then a couple of years down the line, they were doing Annie Get Your Gun, and they wanted kids. And my hand was straight up going, Mum, please, 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 can I be in it? And that was it. That was the first time I set foot on stage. And it was incredible. Never looked back.
Yeah. I wonder, though, will there be extra nerves on the opening night at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre?
No, it's not about that. There's probably perhaps extra excitement,
right,
but not nerves, because, you know, we know the show, we know what we're doing, we know our job is to tell that story. And I think if you get too wrapped up in your own agenda, then it becomes about your own ego as opposed to telling the story and serving the book. So it'll be excitement for sure, but hopefully not nerves.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, you'll have to whistle a happy tune to keep the nerves down, but clearly you're not going to have you're not going to have to do that. We'll come back to that tune in a minute. What about for you then, Darren, as an Asian American playing this role? Obviously, Yul Brynner, for many people, oh, that's who they will see as the king in The King and I. Had you seen that on television or whatever growing up? Or what kind of tradition did you feel you were walking into playing this role?
Yes, I had seen The King and I on television. I'm sure it must have come on at least once a year, and I caught it. And growing up as an Asian American performer, I think it would be impossible to sort of not, in the back of your mind, be aware that there is this role of the King of Siam. And so I'm really, really grateful that my career path and my age and someone happened to be doing a production of the show that has given me the opportunity to inhabit this role.
And when you have seen Yul Brynner playing it, you still, I presume, have to go out there and find your way of doing it. That can't be easy with that huge, you know, 2 Tony Awards, wasn't it? And an Academy Award for that performance from Yul Brynner.
Yeah, yes, certainly. Yul Brynner, they're definitely large shoes to fill. When I approached this role, it's at a latter part in my career, and so I was able to approach it like any other role, and just sort of look at the text, look at the circumstance, look at the character. I honestly did not revisit looking at Yul Brynner's performance when I was cast in this role, and I've not specifically attempted to not do anything that he's done, but at the same time, I've definitely not catered my performance based on his.
Yeah, and I presume you would say the same thing about Deborah Kerr. That was her interpretation, Annalene, of Anna, but you have to find yours.
Absolutely. You know, I think you acknowledge that and you give it the space that it deserves, but you have to find your own version, because when you go out on stage and you're singing these songs and saying these lines 8 times a week, it has to come from a place of your own truth. So you can't go out there and mimic someone else's version, because that's their truth, you know. And it's very important that you feel ownership over a role, and Deborah Kerr was beautiful in the film, and actually at Christmas I did catch a bit when it was on, and I watched I think the scene just before Shall We Dance and into Shall We Dance, and it was really interesting having played the role and then watched that and now playing it again, just sort of looking at different choices that she made. And of course it was filmed back in the 50s, 56, yeah, I think. So, you know, how they portray the characters then, how they filmed it then, it's very different to our version, to Bartlett Sher's direction of the show. Of course, it's the same lines, it's the same songs, but he has approached it in quite a different way. He's really emphasized the female characters, all of the female characters that surround the king, and given their position, weight and value that I don't know, actually, having not seen the whole film in a while, I don't know if they are given that same weight in the movie. But myself, my character of Anna, Tuck Tim, and Lady Tiang, his first wife, Bart has really given them a lot of weight because they're so influential on the king.
Yeah, although I believe he's also giving you, or at least the designer has given you quite a dress to wear for that Shall We Dance scene. The task, I believe, is even greater for you, Darren.
Well, not necessarily. So Shall We Dance, of course, we polka together, and it is definitely a group effort. So Adeline has to wear this beautiful but heavy dress, and I have to find the technique of how to swirl it around and then move forward and then swirl it around and move forward.
Three dancers, I believe.
Yes.
Annalene, Darren, and the dress. Those are the three performers involved in that. You might lead us into so that you don't have any nerves at all then about the opening night. And I'm glad to hear that, Annalene. But you might lead us into Whistle a Happy Tune and where you think what this tells us about her, about that character of Anna.
Yeah, well, I think in this moment in the show, it's right at the top of the show, and she's speaking to her son, and she's, you know, encouraging him to sort of, when you feel worried and when you feel frightened inside, you just have to pretend that everything's okay. Just look okay. It's the whole idea of the swan, isn't it? The feet going 10 to the dozen, but looking graceful on the top. But really, she's sort of singing it for herself. You know, she's terrified of what she's about to do and the step she's about to make. So she sings this song as much for her son as she does for herself.
Well, listen, the very best of luck to both of you for the continued tour, and particularly for the run at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre in Dublin, June the 27th through until July the 1st. Let's listen to Whistle a Happy Tune with Kelly O'Hara, once again in the role of Anna Leon Owens.
Whenever I feel afraid, I hold my head erect and whistle a happy tune so no one will suspect I'm afraid. While shivering in my shoes, I strike a careless pose and whistle a happy tune, and no one ever knows I'm afraid.
That's Kelly O'Hara singing Whistle a Happy Tune from The King and I, but it is Annalene Beachy who will be singing it alongside Darren Lee as the King in The King and I. Annalene playing the character of Anna Leon Owens, and that is at the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, June the 27th through until July the 1st. Full details on boardgoshenergytheatre.ie. Nancy Mitford's beloved novel, The Pursuit of Love, is set in the interwar years and focuses on the upper-class English family, the Radliffs, with its focus particularly on the romantic life of the daughter, Linda. The story is narrated by Linda's cousin, Fanny. The Pursuit of Love has been adapted for the screen on many occasions, most recently with Lily James playing Linda. Now novelist and journalist India Knight, regular critic and well-known for her weekly column in the Sunday Times, has retold The Pursuit of Love in her novel, Darling. India is coming to West Cork Literary Festival on Tuesday week. That's July the 11th. But delighted that she's joining us here on Arena this evening. You were asked, I believe, India, to update, if we like. I don't know what the right word for what you've done with The Pursuit of Love is. It was the Mitford estate that approached you. What did they say to you?
They wanted, yes, I was absolutely approached. I wouldn't have had, you know, the effrontery to kind of volunteer this on my own. Yes, they wanted, I think, I mean, you'd have to ask them, but I think they saw similar things being done with Ian Fleming and Agatha Christie. And I think, you know, being the keepers of the flame, they worry maybe that a whole new generation of people don't really know who Nancy Mitford was. So they asked me to do it, and then I did it, and then I had to show it to them, and they had to approve it, and it was extremely nerve-wracking, but everybody was happy in the end.
Yeah, it was a happy ending in that case. You mentioned effrontery. You wouldn't have had the effrontery to do it yourself. Were you a fan of the original novel, and did that feed into any fears you had around adapting it or updating it in the fashion you have?
Yeah, I was a massive fan of it as a teenager. In fact, I kind of learned Englishness from it. I'm not English. I learned Englishness from it, and I loved it, reread it, you know, once every year or 2 years as a kind of comfort read, and thought that I knew it back to front. I had this kind of idea of it in my head. Didn't entirely kind of correspond too much to the reality, because when I reread it with a view to doing this and kind of read it very scrupulously with a kind of not a nostalgic sort of teenage head on, you know, there were lots of things in it that I wanted to address, and by address I think I really mean kind of get rid of. that you know, it's it's horrendously posh. The attitudes, those sort of post-war attitudes, are in places really quite offensive. So I needed my Radlitz to be very well off in order to mimic the story, which my book does. But I didn't want them to be, you know, the English aristocracy, for heaven's sake. So I made them the children of a retired rock star.
Yeah, which I love. But I'm interested.
Much more egalitarian.
Much more egalitarian. Although I'm not sure if that is an equal world financially. However, let's just hold off on that for a second. You learnt Englishness, you say, from The Pursuit of Love. And then you go on to tell us about what a horrendously posh type of Englishness is presented in that novel. What kind of English do you think it is? Is it one that you don't approve of?
No, I do. I don't mind it. I mean, these people, you know, must be allowed to exist.
Yeah.
I came to, my mother is Pakistani and my father was Belgian. And I came to live in England when I was 9, when my mother remarried an Englishman. So I had to kind of acquire Englishness by osmosis very quickly. And one of my texts was The Pursuit of Love, which made me understand and really like and admire that kind of very languid, kind of everything's funny, nothing is terribly serious. You know, you treat the kind of absolute calamity as if it was a joke and a kind of teeny weeny thing as if it was an absolute calamity. I found it really enlightening, because the English are a peculiar people, and you know, the Pursuit of Love is a brilliant kind of portal into their strange heads, or certainly their strange post-war heads. They're not quite as peculiar anymore, I don't think. So it was a kind of fascinating tool, but also I was enormously charmed by it. I mean, Nancy Mitford was a writer of genius, and the funniness, that it's that kind of mixture of funniness and deep feeling that really kind of resonated with me, because the deep feeling is there. But, you know, the way, for example, a thing that she does very well in that book is the English upper classes can't have feelings, can't express feelings, because they're completely screwed up and constipated. So the only way they can express love is by teasing each other very savagely, often, you know, kind of really kind of black, mean jokes that are very funny. But you also think, gosh, I'm really glad I'm not your sister. So all of that was really fascinating. And that was, again, really fun to reinterpret, because my novel is set in the 21st century.
If you learned your English from them, did you learn those teasing qualities, or did you decide to put those to the one side for your own life, India?
No, there's a tremendous amount of teasing. I think teasing is very good, actually. I'm pro-teasing. I mean, up to a point. I'm also pro, you know, expressing one's emotions like normal people. But I'm pro-teasing, because I think without teasing, you have an awful lot of kind of stuffy, puffed up people waffling on. And if nobody teases them, it's not good.
It's not a good thing. One of the things that struck me, and I wondered about, you know, you say that you read this novel first when you were a teenager yourself. The original novel very much structured around, I suppose, Linda, her main romantic relationships. And I thought, well, was romance in those interwar years, was it a much more constrained type of place for a young woman? Or in fact, when you came to bringing it into the 21st century, did you find more similarities or less similarities than you expected to find about the lot of that pursuit of romance, if you like, or pursuit of love, to give the novel, using the novel's original title?
I don't know. I'm not a historian. My feeling is that in that post-war period, things got kind of loosened up a bit, because everybody was so grateful that the war was over and that nobody was going to go away and die again. So I think Linda's kind of bohemian free spirit, and also I think probably very much of its class, but I think her bohemian free spirit translated actually pretty effortlessly to the 21st century, to the current period.
You were talking there about this idea of, you've updated it to it's essentially the family of a rock star who are living really in the middle of nowhere. How you describe it, probably is described originally as well, that they are living in the rural countryside. Is money, has it become the new class structure? Is that part of the commentary that you would discover in bringing it into the contemporary setting?
I don't know about that. I mean, the Mitford was snobbish. You know, she didn't necessarily know how snobbish she was. She was terribly snobbish, and there was that she did with what's his name, Ross from the University of Gothenburg or something. You and non-you, you know, which demarcated for the delectation of the public words that were common and words that were not accepted usage and non-acceptable usage. So she was a snob, and she was a snob about nouveau riche people. And I had to keep some small bizarre snobberies in my version, but I've tried to make them more universal. I think money is really difficult. You know, money is really difficult, and my characters know how problematic, or the parents certainly know how problematic money is, which is why they choose to live in the absolute arse end of nowhere, partly to shield their children from, you know, the Daily Mail, as it were. And also because logistically I had to have the children in the childhood section, I had to have the children, you know, almost sort of insanely naive. They had to be really, really bored, and they had to have no phones, and they had to have no internet access. So I've put them right in the absolute end of Norfolk, where they can walk and walk and walk and walk and still not leave their father's land, and there's nobody, and there's nobody for them to fancy. They fancy inappropriate aged farmers because there are no boys, there are no children, there's no nothing, there's just them. So that was a kind of important thing to do. So the money facilitates, obviously, walking and walking and never getting off their father's land, but then I didn't want them to be spoilt people.
Yes.
And they are as unspoiled as it's possible to be in those, growing up in those sorts of circumstances, I hope.
It is interesting, though, that and it is quite a task, I think, or a challenge for the contemporary novelist, the presence of the internet, the presence of the mobile phone, the presence of all information at the fingertips of any character. Mm-hmm. You know, you're at a point here where Uncle Matthew, because it's the niece who's narrating the novel, and she often refers to Uncle Matthew in terms of the paterfamilias, in this case, the ex-rock star. He's very keen on keeping the children of the house and of the extended family away from any type of technological, you know, any connection to the internet. There's a modem brought in, I think, at one stage. You can almost hear the doing, doing, doing of the dial-up.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you're touching on that aspect of things. In general, what challenge does that present for the contemporary novelist, the presence of all that technology, you know, in terms of keeping secrets and the like in a novel?
It's very difficult, isn't it? I mean, I cheated by it not existing, really, or existing in a really kind of minute way. The sort of corrupting effect of it is very difficult to ignore. But I mean, people do very well with it. Contemporary novels, you know, manage to weave in, you know, email exchanges, text exchanges, dating apps, whatever, quite kind of deftly. I find it very interrupty. I find it interrupty in life, and I find it very interrupty in fiction. And I've never written anything with an online world in it, and I'm not sure I'd want to really particularly. Because as you say, there are no secrets, and it becomes impossible.
Yeah, because everything is at your fingertips, unfortunately. And even if it's a family secret, it's probably been tweeted by somebody else. The Pursuit of Love, I mean, obviously that recent BBC adaptation was quite well received. And then Darling coming on the back of it. Had you seen that adaptation?
No, I couldn't. I was aware that it was happening, and I couldn't, because I had my world so firmly in my head that, you know, with the best will in the world, you know, when you sort of, you have to be very careful when you write stuff, because you kind of accidentally, inadvertently copy. So when I write this sort of fiction, for example, I only ever read crime novels, because I know that I'm not going to suddenly start writing a hard-boiled detective with a drink problem in my book. But it happens so easily, you know, sort of by osmosis, you pick up other people's stuff. So I absolutely didn't watch it at the time, and actually I haven't watched it since either. But I gather it was good. But no, I wanted my idea of it, which was really precise. I mean, it was I could almost see it in 3D. I wanted to keep that and preserve it from contamination by any other version.
Yeah, and I was speaking with Barbara Kingsolver recently. Obviously, she won the Women's Prize for Fiction just last week for Demon Copperhead, which is essentially a retelling, a resetting of Dickens's David Copperfield. She talked about using the I suppose, the structure, the narrative structure that Dickens had put in place, the plot scaffolding, I think was the exact phrase that she used, using that. How did that work with you and Nancy Mitford? Did you, you know, how regularly did you go back to The Pursuit of Love when you were writing Darling?
That's a really good question. When it took me a really long time to write because I really, really wanted to get it right. And it was a laborious process. But so at the beginning, when I sat down to, well, at the beginning, I didn't sit down to write it. At the beginning, I was incredibly pleased to have been asked. I strutted around. I was felt just so pleased and proud. And then I sat down to write it and I thought, what am I doing? What am I doing? How dare I? How dare I approach this kind of semi-sacred text? And then I started writing it literally with the book next to my laptop on my desk. And I found that very inhibiting because that was like pastiche or ventriloquy. You know, that didn't work. It read all right, but it was stupid. So I read it one last time, closed it, put it in another room and worked from the version that was in my head, which I think is the only sane way to do it. So the bones, the skeleton of the story is absolutely there. But it's my flesh on it.
And the other aspect of that, I suppose, that I think is interesting, you know, there seems to be a spate of it. It's not just Demon Copperhead. It's not just, and to be fair, you were asked to do this. It wasn't that you came up with this yourself. But I'm thinking of, in recent times, you know, the number of Greek myths that have been brought into some kind of modern situation as well in terms of literature. What do you make of that trend of taking those old stories and essentially modernizing them? Are we running out of stories? Are there a finite number?
It's really bizarre, isn't it? No, there isn't a finite number of stories. It's the same with TV and with theatre, actually. You know, the same old things again and again, round and round, as if nobody had the imagination to think up anything new. Yeah. I think there's maybe an element of kind of post-COVID comfort in there somewhere. I think hearing the old stories told a fresh way makes people maybe feel cozy and makes people feel that the book they're reading is friendly and known or sort of semi-known, as opposed to a great big, you know, new, strange, challenging entity. Maybe. But it is odd. I mean, everything is going round and round, particularly on television in the UK. Everything is a remake of something from the 70s. It's amazing.
Maybe it's making Britain great again, perhaps.
Oh, India. God, let's not go there.
Well, I have to, because you have a you have a wonderful UKIP character in the book.
Yes.
I mean, obviously there
yes,
are.
I do.
Yeah, just explain who he is, and maybe the parallel in the Nancy Mitford story, which I think is quite interesting. How you've changed it slightly in that respect.
So, in the original, in The Pursuit of Love, is he Lord Croesic? I think he is Lord Croesic. He's a kind of vulgar made man in the original. I've made him a UKIP peer, and I could have made him much more terrible, actually. And he's got a terrible son, and Linda sort of accidentally marries Tony Croesic, his terrible, terrible son, who's really kind of flash and who woos her with expensive presents and who is just this sort of absolute toad, really, but good looking. Although she decides in the end he's too good looking, she thinks his face is, you know, too symmetrical and too perfect and looks like it came from a department store. And he's awful anyway. And she has married him absolutely by mistake and had a baby with him by mistake, which is, you know, really some mistake. So they're the kind of, And they're very impressed. They're very obsessed with status and cachet, and they're keen to insert themselves into London society, and they feel profoundly grieved when they don't get asked to the right party. And they think that Linda, being the daughter of the rock star, will inject this kind of bohemian glamour into their lives, and she hates them, so she refuses to. And that doesn't end particularly happily, that relationship.
And of course, there is the parallel in terms of, isn't it, Diana Mitford, who famously left her husband to run away with Oswald Mosley, who would have been of the British Union of Fascists. There really are. Were you frightened by the number of parallels you saw between 1930s Britain? Because this has been the subject of much discussion in recent times as well. 1930s Britain and 20 whatever the second decade of the 21st century.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a sort of creeping. There's a creeping something, isn't there, both here and particularly in America. I mean, I won't pretend that I wrote those scenes with that in mind. But I mean, the echo was certainly, you know, resonating in my head. And it's interesting that you should bring up Diana. And of course, there's Unity Mitford, who had such a massive crush on Hitler that off she trotted to Berlin. And on the day that Germany and Britain declared war, shot herself in the head in the English Garden. In Berlin, and was shipped back and lived out her days a kind of poor creature, cared for by her mother on a on an island on a Scottish island. I think this may have been part of the Mitford estate's desire, to have somebody really the pursuit of love. You know, the Mitfords are increasingly in the public imagination. If younger people remember them, it's for all of that kind of. All those, you know, I mean, unpleasant isn't the word. There's really dark, terrible associations. There's Unity, there's Diana, as you say, and Oswald Mosley. And Diana, Nancy shopped Diana to the authorities, in fact, and Diana never knew until after Nancy's death. But Nancy was the one who wrote saying, arrest my sister, she's a dangerous person. So underneath all of this froth, there's
a lot of darkness. You're talking about when I mentioned UKIP, etc. You said, let's not go there. Is that what West Cork gives you? Because I know you holiday there regularly, and indeed that's where you're going to be.
Yes,
for the,
I do.
Does it get you out of that darkness?
It does. Yes, it does. I mean, I don't know what's going on. I think we're going to have a new government, but not soon enough. And, you know, the kind of endless rumblings of the endless aftershocks, and the way the debate never seems to move forward. It's so circular. And there are all these sort of crazy people who are still obsessed with Brexit. They got their Brexit. Nobody can go abroad without it being a massive rigmarole. You know, well done. There you go. It's all done. And they're still going on. And, they're still saying it didn't go far enough. I just find it very, very wearing, to put it politely.
Well, hopefully you can get to West Cork without too much bureaucratic difficulty for both your holidays and for your events. Thanks for speaking with us this evening, India.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
That's India Knight, whose new novel, Darling, is published by Penguin, and India will be at the West Cork Literary Festival on July the 11th. Festival runs from July the 7th through to the 14th. Full information on West Cork Literary Festival. .ie. And that is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Keshi. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.